In December of 1978, off the coast of New Zealand, a series of events unfolded which not only changed the lives of the witnesses, left skeptics stumped, and has given believers so much evidence that to this day, it is still considered the most credible proof of UFO contact available to the public. This is the Kaikoura Lights. I didn't see you there.
Something big is going on here.
From hunting ghosts to Bigfoot.
Paranormal, UFOs, true crime, and more.
We won't just be spouting articles.
I was researching for your entertainment.
The beginning of a new world.
The best guac you'll ever fucking eat.
True story.
It's basically like one day you walk outside and you see that the ants are playing with matches.
This is the Black Cat Report.
See you on the other side.
Hello everyone, and welcome to episode 77 of the Black Cat Report. My name is Gil, and I'll be your freelance cameraman this evening as we document the adventures of one intrepid young reporter, the Emmy-nominated Joey.
Well, thank you for that gracious and welcome. I really am pretty humble about that. You know, every time I just talk about how great I am, I'm doing amazing, and I really appreciate you talking about my Emmy, you know?
Yeah, is it all right that I know in the writer that I got, you know, sent from your agent that I was supposed to bring up the many science fair awards that you received. Is it all right that I left that out, or should we re-record this?
I mean, you have to mention my elementary school science fair award for the volcano that erupted. The paper airplane that flew the farthest.
That was true.
Want to say, I can't even remember the last one, but it's in the writer. You should have it and brought it up, but it's no big deal.
We'll talk about
it later too, you know.
Now real quick, I just want to touch on today's sources. There are many. I went through a lot of different documentaries, a lot of articles, and just tried to grab up as many resources as I could about this event.
Mm-hmm.
Links to all of that will be in the show notes, along with a link to a playlist of all the documentaries and the film that's referenced in this episode. So definitely check that out. But before we dive in, got to give a few shout outs, right? Kind of wanted to start this tradition here. So First up is Crystal. They've been a long-time listener and have always been super supportive of the show. Couldn't appreciate you enough. And especially, you know, one thing that stuck out to me was last week, she specifically reached out to say that the Humanoids for the Holidays episode made her laugh and that she loved it. And it was definitely, at least for us, a different vibe than our normal show. And you saying that, like, really, really made our day. So thank you.
Thank you, Crystal. Seriously. You know, we aren't really comedians. We're just like researchers. So to hear that we made you laugh and some, you know, and you enjoyed the episode, we really appreciate it because, you know, me and Gil are just, we like to research stuff.
Yeah, we out here. But, and I did want to also add too that I haven't forgotten your suggestion from honestly forever ago about covering an ancient mystery. We finally tracked down a good one that's not overplayed on the History Channel, and I'll just say we have it in the works. It's coming up, early 2024. So, also want to give a special shout out to Samuel. Now, Samuel found us just before Thanksgiving and actually hit us up on our Instagram account, like on Thanksgiving evening, and it was just to tell us how much he's enjoying what we do on the show and to like chat a little bit. Dude, that made my evening when I saw that. It made me so happy. You know, I'm just sitting there at my house just kind of eating some food, and I looked down and you just reached out. Seriously though, like, thank you. And y'all, I can't begin to tell you how much your feedback, like, honestly keeps us going, like keeps us motivated when we're researching and writing at 3 a.m. after working all day long, right?
Mm-hmm.
Those brief little Vada boys and pats on the back, like, they mean the world to us. Seriously.
Mm-hmm.
Doors always open for that. It always puts a smile on our face. And between Joey and I, somebody's always awake.
One of us is always awake and, you know, memeing the other person, being like, hey, check this meme out, or did you see this and stuff like that. So, yeah.
Yeah. And let's see. Last one here. Finally, got to give a shout out to a new subscriber, Nellie from Lunar Station in Toledo, Ohio. Now, Nelly, you didn't know this when you subscribed to us today, but you helped us hit our personal goal for new subscribers by the end of the year. So, like, thank you. Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm. We are at that goal.
Yeah, we've had this number since it's like January or February at the beginning of 2023. And I was just kind of like looking at the numbers today of subscribers on Spotify and stuff. And I was like, oh, we're so close. We're so close. And then, you know, I get these messages. So made our day. Thank you. Thank you so much. And for that alone, we want to give you a very special welcome to Black Cat Report just for you. And also an unpaid, unsolicited plug for the Lunar Station, your counterculture destination in Northwest Ohio and Southeast Michigan. With 7 locations to choose from, you can rest assured they've got you covered when it comes to your smoke shop needs. With a wide range of glass, vaporizers, incense, tobacco accessories, clothing, tapestries, disc golf discs, and accessories, Lunar Station is your new home base for when you need to come back down to Earth to pick up supplies for your next trip. And you can find an unpaid, unsolicited link to learn more about Lunar Station down in our show notes.
He literally practiced that a billion times before he did this. So
I stole most of that from their website, I'm going to be honest.
Oh, well, that's perfect. It works, yeah.
Plagiarizing, and, you know, they didn't approve this message at all. But
that's fine. But go there. If you're in that area, go there and enjoy.
Definitely. Now, our story begins on October 21st, 1978, with the disappearance of Frederick Valentech, an Australian pilot whose last known recordings capture his frantic final moments as he's radioing Melbourne Air Traffic Control and saying he's being followed and threatened by a large unknown object circling his plane. Before his final transmission, he tells the Melbourne Traffic Control operators the UFO is now hovering above him. Then there's silence, intense static, and ultimately a massive sea and air search, which leaves only speculation and mystery. But that's not our case today.
I was just going to say it's probably just a giant kangaroo flying around there.
I've been warned about this. Drop bears.
What are drop bears?
Okay, well, they're these bears that live up in the trees in Australia, and during parts of the year, they'll fall out of the trees and they can injure, kill you, or attack you.
Mm-hmm.
And they're entirely made up, and they're used by people who live in Australia to fuck with tourists, basically.
So. Oh, that's pretty funny. You're always just looking up in the trees, wondering where there's a bear going to drop on you.
Y'all couldn't see Joey's face, but he was like totally into it. He's like, that sounds like Australia. That
100%. Yeah, I mean, yeah. So. I was just thinking, like, are koalas in Australia? Yeah, I mean, koalas, they might fall off a tree and hurt you.
Drop bears. Well, our story actually starts, the real meat and potatoes of our story starts 2 months after that, right? So 2 months later, on the night of December 21st, 1978, at an Air Force base located on New Zealand's southernmost island near the town of Belem, around 11:30 p.m. Royal New Zealand Air Force officer Ian Uffendall was on a routine patrol around the base property as he crossed over the tarmac and noticed bright lights off into the distance. Thinking they were just, you know, landing lights of a plane coming in, he continued on with his route. But as time passed and he completed his patrol, Ian would glance back over to the runway and realize that the bright landing lights he'd seen earlier had in fact remained stationary. Curious, he headed up to the control tower to get a better view. Once there, he grabbed a pair of binoculars and focused them on the intense light. It was moving, erratically, going forward, then reversing before finally splitting into three distinct lights. These lights then continued the odd ballet as before, but now, in a sequenced dance, they were forming geometric patterns with their maneuvers. Like, this is trippy as fuck.
This guy's tripping balls right now.
Ian, what did you take? Drop bear glands.
Yeah. So, oh,
the new street chug.
That is the new thing, actually.
Well, all the while, these lights that were dancing in the sky at the end of the airport, basically, they were shining beams of light down onto the ground below them. Right, so this is getting even more weird. And after a quick check with the crew in the control tower, Ian confirmed the objects were showing up on radar. Whatever was causing the light show was certainly real and present in their airspace. At that point, Ian reached out to the air traffic control tower at Wellington, a civilian airport on New Zealand's northern island.
Mm-hmm.
This is the opposite end of the country, still tiny though, so their radar is capturing everything as well, right?
Mm-hmm. But
during this call, traffic control operator John Cordry confirmed to Ian that not only was the object appearing on their radar as well, but that they had been watching it on radar after receiving calls about it all evening.
Weird.
So now we have multiple confirmations. We have the visual sighting.
Uh-huh.
We have a close-up visual sighting with the binoculars. We have the radar at the base.
Uh-huh.
And then we have a radar on the opposite end of the country. And then we also have people calling in the country being like, what's going on over there?
Yeah,
you
yeah.
know, just like...
the annoying like, neighbor that's always just like, did you see what's going on yeah. next door? Miss Willingham's house?
Trying to sleep. Well... So currently, we have an object or objects hovering near an Air Force base for over an hour. Remember, this all began around 11:30 at night.
Mm-hmm.
Civilian and military radar are tracking them. Citizens are calling about the lights, and no one has any clue what they are or what the fuck is going on.
Mm-hmm.
Well, with confusion all around, Cordry, the radio control tower operator that answered Ian's call up in Wellington, right, he decided to radio the pilots of two separate cargo planes who were both flying routes that would take them near the floating mystery lights. It's a good move, mm-hmm. right? He's like, well, it yeah. looks like these folks are coming in this way and this guy's coming in this way. I'm just going to have them and take a look over there, just a little flyabout. Well, so he didn't give away too much information because he also didn't really know that much. He basically told them, hey, we've got an unknown showing up on radar. Here's the coordinates. If you get the chance, we'd really appreciate it if you could swing by and radio back what you see.
Mm-hmm.
Simple, right? And they both agreed to it.
Did they crash into each other?
No.
They both
it's
at coming the same
towards
time.
Me!
It's coming towards me. And it's just both of their lights shining. I see him. I think I see him, and they just ran into, oh, that would be really sad.
Mystery solved. Yeah, so keep in mind, we're well yeah. past when Officer Ian mistook them for landing lights around 11:30, so this is getting up into the evening. Those lights are still there.
Yep.
Well, of the two cargo planes en route to the location, the first to arrive in the area is being flown by Captain Vern Powell, along with his co-pilot, First Officer Ian Peary. Seeing nothing as they made their approach, they finally entered into the search area. Both men just slowly going into this being like, I don't know what he's talking about. I don't know what he's looking at. You know, like just like going
yeah, yeah.
there. Like it's, you know, it's nighttime. they're like.
Just guess. Just swamp guess.
Yeah, yeah. And it's also, you know, December 21st. It's the winter solstice. Shortest day of the year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right? So like pitch black. At 11:30, and they're just like, well, there's nothing really going on here. There's nothing going on. And that's when both men were completely horrified as a massive light, quote, the size of a house burning in the sky, emerged from a cloud right next to them on the left side of their plane. This this UFO straight up played peekaboo with them.
So their description of it was a massive light the size of a house burning in the sky. That's such an odd way to describe it, because who pictures a house that's burning in the sky?
I immediately pictured Walter White from Breaking Bad
uh-huh.
having bought the house from the movie Up.
Yeah, that's probably, yes, yes.
That was my first thought. You know, this is like yes. the early years.
Cooking meth yeah. up in the sky.
Just yeah. cooking meth. Dropping it on Ian as he's patrolling.
Yep.
But...
I feel like that's what the guy at Up did. And Up did before you got old.
How do you think his wife died?
That's a very sad story.
I've refused to watch it because of how horribly sad it is. And I'm sensitive, dude.
Mm-hmm.
I ain't got time for that shit.
For sure. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
That description, you're right, though. Like, it's so weird. It almost has to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
Because you can tell the person was literally struggling with an example. And they're like, I don't know. It was like a house in the sky that was on fire.
Damn, that's so weird.
It's like, that is such a strange description, but it's like, damn, they were really trying to find a description for it. Well,
yeah.
After the shock wore off, they called into Wellington Tower and proceeded to describe what they were witnessing as they flew around the object for the next few minutes. All the while, both the radar crews, the ones working in Wellington and the ones at the Air Force base, watched the strange object and the frightened pilots flying near it until they made the decision to get the fuck out of there. So they're basically circling around. They're like, yep, nope, it's here. Yep, it looks like this. Yeah, we're going to go.
A burning house. They said the same thing to describe it. It just looks like a burning house. It's like, my God, how many burning houses do we have in this country, in the sky?
Someone needs to put a stop to this. But no, for real, like, how horrified would you be if you're flying and for the 15, 20 minutes on the way into an area, you're just staring into a spot you're supposed to be looking at. You don't see shit. You don't see any lights. You don't see nothing. Mm-hmm. And then as you're in the area, an object just, whoa, like, literally pops up right the fuck next to you in the sky.
That's crazy.
That's horrifying.
Yeah,
that's
it's like, bad.
I mean, anything within 1,000 feet, like aircraft within 1,000 feet of each other, is considered like way too much of a close call.
Yeah, yeah.
And this shit just like pops out of the clouds. Hey, peekaboo. So yeah, as the story unfolds, it does feel like this area is a little bit of like a singles bar for UFOs.
It does.
So they watched the strange object and, you know, eventually they were just like, all right, you know, fuck this. And they dipped out.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Well, by now in the timeline, it's around 2 a.m., 2.5 hours since this all started. The first plane had already left. They skedoodled. And now the second plane requested to investigate the area was starting to arrive. Well, for the second crew, there was no peekaboo moment, luckily for them, mm-hmm. making their pilot's pants way more luckily than the first set of pilot's pants.
Yes.
All the second plane's pilot's pants had to deal with was just the massive intensity of the lit object, right? This overwhelming light that was in front of mm-hmm. them floating in the sky, which, you know, as they're slowly approaching to it, they kind of have time to kind of adapt to it and be like, what is that? It's more mystery than kind of like, you know,
yeah.
Jump scares. Well, they confirmed with air traffic control and described it before heading back out, you know, and just kind of continuing on their way. So they're like, yeah, there is some strange shit over here. We're looking at it. Yada, yada. Okay, we're on our way out. Like, that was wild. We're gone.
Yeah.
Well, by sunrise, word of what played out overnight and continued well into the morning spread fast, like really fast. Well, it made its way through networks of friends and family until finally it arrived on the desks of local news stations, which highlighted the story in their December 22nd evening broadcast. So it happened that morning and already made the news that evening. The shit just,
yeah,
poof.
That's crazy. Yeah. Yeah, that's so quick.
Yeah, and like we're talking about 14 or 15 hours. It went from the radar rooms to the newsrooms. That mm-hmm. is, whoo, like this
lightning
story
fast.
Took off. Yeah, like UFO
fast. That's burning
fast.
House fast.
Yeah, it's like burning house sky. UFO fast. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
By the 23rd, right, so the next day after that, it was being talked about on every radio station and printed in every newspaper across New Zealand. The shit was, you know, like you were saying, it was spreading like burning houses, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But it didn't stop at the border. The buzz surrounding the event that night quickly catapulted across the water and landed directly in the ears of serial holiday pooper and Channel Zero news producer Lee Leonard. Now, Lee had the holiday heart of, let's say, a shitty fintech company and couldn't give a kangaroo's crap less about whose time off he had to ruin if it meant getting what he wants. And what he wanted was Channel Zero in Australia to be the first in Aussie land to report on the Kiwi chaos. So he called and questioned everyone he could until finally he was able to be connected to Channel Zero news correspondent Quinton Fogarty, who was on vacation and relaxing with his family in New Zealand.
Yeah.
I say all that because as I dove in and kind of like looked at the chain of events, I was like, wait a second, this is 1978.
Yeah.
Lee wasn't able to just like text or email Quinton.
Yeah. He was like calling random people until in the town to just get his number.
There's only so many on the island. You know?
Yeah, yeah. I'll get him sometime.
Yeah. So he had to keep calling and calling and calling and calling while everybody's gone. Everybody's on vacation. Everybody's, you know, on break and stuff like that. Until finally, he was able to get the home phone number for Quinton's parents' house, which he was at with his family.
Damn.
You know that was a long process.
Oh, for sure. That guy is tenacious.
Yes.
To get all that stuff. And he's just like, please, let me talk to these people. It'd be funny if they were just like, nope, boom. I'm on vacation.
I imagine there was a few of those. But with that said, Quinton was, in fact, the right guy in the right place at the right time for this report, even if it was the worst time for his vacation. You see, to add further fuel to the fire, before going on his holiday getaway, Quinton had spent most of the last 2 months reporting on the strange UFO-related disappearance of Frederick Valentich. So, like, this, that UFO-related shit and, like, aviation UFO-related, like, mysteries that's what he was kind of already specializing on for the 2 months before. He's like, need a break from that. Gonna go see the family, you know, and like went back to New Zealand, was hanging out with his family. So he was kind of like, actually, you're kind of the perfect reporter for our station to like be covering this.
Yeah.
And you are literally already there. Well, like any good reporter, he didn't hesitate to jump on a chance to follow a new lead. Quentin agreed. So fast forward now from that phone call to the night of December 30th, just 7 days and a holiday later.
Mm-hmm.
And that short span of time, freaking Lee, pulled off two things that were critical to this case. The first, he managed to call and pester enough people until he finally found and hired two professional freelancers to film and record Quentin's report. Again, Quentin's the only one there. This is 1978. They didn't just have, you know, he couldn't just pull out his cell phone and start recording, like, live streaming this shit. They needed, like, a crew for this news report, right? The second miracle that he performed, really, he somehow managed to get a hold of the air freight company whose planes were involved on the night of the 21st and convince them to recreate and retrace the same flight, but with his news crew on board as passengers.
That's cool.
I mean, that's fucking awesome. But he, again, the amount of people he's calling and harassing.
Oh, yeah. He's like calling the bosses too.
Got a present for you. Free promotion in Australia. How does that sound? Yeah. All right. So we got this crew. They're going to be there on Monday. You know, and they're just like, who is this?
Yeah. Who is
Lee Leonard, of course. Like, you know.
Dang, the alliteration in the name got me.
Dude, a lot of these names in this episode are fucking chef's kiss. They're freaking awesome. So like I said, fast forward through all that, Lee pulled off some fucking miracles, right? Pulled a lot of strings, got a lot of people together again, and like over the holiday season, no real technology to help him out. This is all phone books, operators, and pestering people.
Yeah.
You know, the kind of person you want as a producer for a news channel.
For sure.
So at 11:46 p.m. on December 30th, Captain Bill Startup and his first officer, Bob Gard, lifted the Argosy cargo plane off the Wellington Airport runway with the ad hoc Channel Zero news crew on board. Quentin Fogarty, the reporter, audio specialist Nyree Crockett, and Nyree's husband, David Crockett, the cameraman.
Old Davy Crockett.
Old Davy Crockett. You know he got that. So Nyree's an awesome-ass name. It's spelled N.
I like Nyree. That's really cool.
N-G-I-A-R-E. I had to look that up. A lot of times it's like Nyree. Nyree. Like when you look up pronunciations, this one was just like Nyree. Yep. Once you see it, you'll never forget. And I was like, damn, they write
it. Yeah, that's in the Google translation.
It was. It was the first video that came up. But anyway, So they took off at 11:46 p.m., and by the time they had reached cruising altitude, their flight was already retracing one of the routes from 9 days earlier, almost down to the minute. Now, this flight from where they left in Wellington to Christchurch, both in New Zealand, is basically going along the eastern coast of New Zealand's southernmost island, right? There's a massive mountain chain. Picture Lord of the Rings, right? So big, beautiful, like, mountains and all that stuff like that.
Yep.
And butting right up against the coast.
Mm-hmm.
So hold up your left hand and make, like, kind of like a C shape. It's kind of going from your thumb to your index finger, right? And, like, the coastline being along the edge of your hand. So they're going over water. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Again, we have the exact same cargo plane.
Yeah.
Right. Flying the exact same route. Leaving at the exact same time. Right.
Yeah.
They've gotten so many things down to the detail. And Joey, I just want to take this moment to point out there is nothing TV news reporters love more than yelling a story at a camera while awkwardly LARPing in a suit.
Yeah, and they're punning everything, too. Everything's got to be a pun.
They just, like, and then they awkwardly cut over to some random person. They're like, so what do you think about what happened? And they're just like, I mean, I think, you know, as long as people mind their own business, you know, then everything's okay. But not everyone agreed. I, for instance, don't like that they put in that Walmart over there. And that's me reporting live.
They always cut off that one person that has nothing to do, like talking in the background.
But they always pick the loudest fucking spots.
Do you remember when that one thing, like you were talking about how they like will jump in the, you know, kind of cosplay everything?
Yeah.
Do you remember that one where the weatherman was in the ditch in the water and then showed on like Instagram reels and stuff later, people were filming him and he was just like, there was no water anywhere except for that ditch around him. And he's trying to say, the monsoon is the worst we've ever seen this year.
I don't even know how I'm standing in this boat. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Idiot over there.
Oh, my God. No, that shit. I love that. But that's true. Like, I honestly think that's true. There's nothing a TV news reporter loves more than just fucking awkwardly LARPing in a suit. It's always in a
Sensationalism.
Suit.
Sensationalism.
Always very awkward. Only hours ago, 16 people died right here, just stepping over top of them and shit.
Yeah, stepping over bodies and just like 16 people died right here, and we're just being careful not to disturb the crime scene. And they're like kicking stuff over.
Now we have special permission to. No, you don't go through this crime scene. Just, damn it. Well, anyways, so. Yeah, but their goofiness aside, right? This ad hoc news crew's goofiness aside, I have to give them credit. Even though they're trying to film all this, you know, and all of this work and all this planning and all the string pulling over the holidays was put together so that they could try to record a reel in the back of a cargo plane, an uninsulated cargo plane. So they're in a flying hollow shipping container, right?
Yep. Yeah, pretty much.
Which, like, do you know how loud planes are when they aren't insulated? Like, planes are loud. It's... Even passenger planes are fucking loud when you're in them.
Yeah.
And so all this work just to be like, all right, now we're recording in a giant steel container that's vibrating.
You just don't even hear them. You just see them mouthing stuff. And it's like, oh, I guess that's just the news for today. Nothing.
And I'm saying all this to prepare you for when y'all actually see the video of what gets recorded. Obviously, shit gets recorded, right?
Yeah.
Well, like I was saying, so their goofiness aside, I have to give them credit because it paid off, right? Almost on cue, like literally, like almost down to the exact beat. When Quentin and crew finished recording the intro reel, Captain Startup yelled back to them that they needed to hurry up and get in the cockpit. And that's when they first saw the lights. With all five of the people on the plane crammed into this tiny cockpit, trying to see and record video of what's going on outside of the plane through the tiny windows in the front. This is not built for passengers.
No, no, it's a cargo plane. Yeah.
Well, at first, what they all said that they saw was basically just small pinpoints. To quote Quentin, pulsating pinpricks of light that would grow into great globes of light. So it was just kind of, what's that over there? That's not supposed to be there. Like, that might be them, right? But they're all fixated. They're all fascinating by this. But soon, one of the lights grew larger than the others, while the smaller lights started maneuvering around it, fading out and reappearing over and over and over again, then popping up next to the larger light. So shit's getting trippy. And speaking about this whole moment, Nyree Crockett would later say that these were the brightest lights she had ever seen in her life, that during this encounter, the entire inside of the plane from cockpit to cargo hold was lit up like daytime. This is nuts.
Yeah, it's a burning house for sure.
Right? Also keep in mind now, so nothing going on here is stationary. All these folks are flying in a plane at hundreds of miles an hour. So whatever was controlling these lights, operating them, was also intentionally moving the light show with them as this time was passing. They're coming up and they're approaching. They're watching this happening. But then at some point, they kind of, I don't know, hit a stride where they're both moving alongside of each other.
Mm-hmm.
And the object's still like, oh, now look, watch me dance. You know, like it's the UFO singles bar.
Yeah, yes.
This is their mating call. Now, for a skeptic, the first thought is always Venus, right? Acting like anything but a planet, as she often does. But that doesn't exactly explain the, I don't know, nuclear reaction level of light that they're all seeing. Okay.
So yeah.
A little bit more than just a bright planet.
And it's moving.
Yeah, and it's moving. There's that too. Or how Venus was somehow able to appear in the sky hours before she was scheduled to that night. So that also kind of puts a damper into that whole situation. And it doesn't come close at all to explaining what happens next. And this, honestly, is a key moment here. So as they're flying along, all staring at the lights, while David, the cameraman, is smooshed in there trying not to hit all the buttons and switches in the cockpit or, like, I don't know, block the captain's view as he's filming all of this on one of those old school cameras with the giant film reels. If you're trying to look for what they look like, just type in like film or camera into like a text message. It's the emoji that pops up. It's literally one of those old school reel to reel cameras.
The reels, yeah.
Yeah. So five people, tiny cockpit, surrounded by a bajillion little switches and buttons and dials and stuff. And a fucking news crew up there while the plane is flying, trying to get to these windows. Yeah. So it was an awkward situation. Let's put it that way.
For sure.
Well, what happens next, though? The pilot, Captain Startup, does something that honestly should have gotten him nominated for the MUFON Medal of Honor. The captain turns the nose of the plane towards the massive glowing object and flies the plane directly over top of one of the lights.
Wow.
Holy shit. Like, first off, best tour guide ever. Like, God,
he was literally
damn.
Trying to kamikaze that thing, too.
Dude, like I've heard accounts of people flying next to UFOs or around them or even being circled by one, but I've never heard of a full-on Independence Day style, in the words of my generation, up yours, like, fucking...
Yeah,
like,
literally trying to drive into it.
Dude fucking went for it.
Damn.
Please, for the love of God, I get him a raise. Like, get him a raise. This is a routine mail run that they rescheduled so that it lined up with what the reporters and the agency and shit like that, the channel, wanted to do.
Yeah.
It's just a fucking mail run. This guy, this isn't even the same pilot as that other night. This is somebody completely different. He's like, well, we're going to go for it. Just fucking turns
towards this shit. This dude probably does this same little run all the time, too. And he's probably just like, I finally get to have some fun. Do you know, like, hey, buckle in. Let's see if we can throw these guys out the back.
Y'all got any rope back there? Any rope? Yeah, I think I found some. You might want to tie yourselves down. But that daredevil move, though, flying over one, in my opinion, and in the opinion of all the people involved, became a key moment that frankly shuts down later arguments by skeptics and debunkers who try to pass off the sightings as lights down in the water. Or that they were maybe the reflection of the moon, right? Which it couldn't have been a reflection of the moon, or it would have been really hard, because December 30th, 1978, it was a new moon. Only 3.03% of it was even visible that night. And if it was something else, say, not a reflection, but, I don't know, the lights of a Japanese squid fishing boat, which later became a common dismissal, then that still doesn't explain how during all of this, Wellington Air Traffic Control was not only confirming and logging these interactions, but actively tracking the objects on radar. Now, how does all this add up to not flying over a reflection or a Japanese squid disco boat?
Well, Squisco.
A Squisco boat. Well, almost immediately after their wild flyover, Wellington radioed in to inform the captain that the largest object, the giant bright light, right?
Yeah.
Was now following directly behind the plane. It was tailing them.
Damn.
So they flew over and it's like, hey, motherfucker, and like popped up and up started following them. And it would continue to follow them up until a few minutes before they landed in Christchurch at 1:01 a.m.
Damn.
This shit started around 11:50. So it's over
an hour. Yeah, about an hour and a half. Yeah, dang. That thing followed him for a long time, too.
It was pissed, you know?
It was pissed. I mean, to be it can move way faster than them, probably. It was just like, you know what's even more annoying? If somebody follows you and shines a bright light in your rearview mirrors. That's the most annoying thing if you're driving down there, so I can only imagine.
Hey, who are you calling a squid boat?
The aliens adopted New Zealand accent, I feel like.
Of course, yeah. Masters of disguise.
True. Yeah, they just have a mustache.
So I just pictured a classic like silver UFO with just a handlebar mustache.
Just the UFO has the mustache.
Jets come
up. Nothing to see here.
Jets come up on the side like two fighter jets. Did you see the objects? He went that way. Oh, thank you. Was he from New Zealand? Yeah, I think so. Well, yeah, so this whole encounter lasted for a little over an hour, and it's completely in line with what witnesses reported about their sightings on the 21st. This shit matches up, and it actually, it clarifies a number of things that were reported on the 21st. So the location and time, check, right? The extended contact and visuals, check. a large luminescent object that splits into multiple lights. Now, that wasn't reported on the flight, but they're closer this time. They're actually right the fuck next to it until eventually they're over it. And
yeah.
That actually explains what they said they saw there, explains what people were seeing, specifically Ian, from far away on the 21st. He said that there was a large bright object that then like split up and started moving around.
Mm-hmm.
What this crew of folks saw was a large object with smaller objects kind of dancing and moving around it that were also phasing in and out of appearance and popping up next to it. So if you're far away, you're looking at it, they might have been directly in front of that bright light as they're circling around and dancing. So
true,
the moment he saw it, it may have looked like one large object, and then all of a sudden it's splitting off into little ones moving around. That actually still tracks 100% with what the folks saw when they were, you know, 100 feet away from it or whatever. What else? The wild geometric movements, constant radar confirmation, like not for moments, but literally hours.
Yeah.
And the interaction between the lights and the aircraft. All of these things, it's the exact same behavior, the exact same appearance, the exact same description, same location, everything as what had happened 9 days earlier, right? As I said, they landed in Christchurch, New Zealand at 1:01 a.m. So it's now December 31st, New Year's Eve, 1978. But the night's not over.
Sit.
Shortly after touchdown, another call comes in. This time it's from Willington to let air traffic control in Christchurch know the objects are still showing up on radar near the mountain range.
Wow.
still out there, dude.
Yeah, and as they drove by, as the plane goes by, they go look at him. The alien just goes, "See you next year." I made that one up. Yeah.
Well, with no hesitation, like seriously, no hesitation, Quentin and David want to go back for round two. They're like, "Holy, they're still out there."
Of course, so, they did.
I mean, you know, there's not like side view mirrors on an airplane.
No, there's not. So they gotta like see it head
on. No fucking windows in the cargo area. So they just have those tiny little windows that the pilots are seeing out of this whole damn time. So the entire time they were being followed, they were relying on air traffic control operators to tell them, hey, it's literally right the fuck behind you. But they couldn't see anything, right?
Yeah.
And so they're like, well, shit, you know, it was super awkward the first time trying to film all this, trying to see all this. Because again, they're trying to report on fucking UFOs, and they're witnessing fucking UFOs.
This is insane. Like, what the fuck?
This is fucking wild. It is literally a professional news crew reporting on UFOs, recording UFOs live.
Yeah, that's this so interesting. Yeah.
So they jump at the chance to go back for round two. And the pilots, who are clearly the ones to call when you need to do some crazy shit, they're down to go back up immediately. They're like, yeah, let's fucking do it. Let's fucking go, mate.
Why not? Why not?
But here's the thing, though. Nairi, ever since just before they landed, right, to when they were deciding what to do, had become physically ill, right? She was quickly becoming sick and was, in all honesty, horrified by what they had just witnessed. Keep in mind, first off, anybody would be just, take it all out of context. If you went through some shit like that, you'd be like, what the fuck? And then also you're like, hey, this pilot didn't even ask us and decided to fucking go right near this. Also, she's probably, I don't know, considering the fact that exactly 2 months ago, or 2 months and a week ago, pilot may have been killed by a similar object back in October. This was all over the news right then, right? The actual reporter who you're now on the team with, he was one of the people reporting on this.
Damn.
This is all top of mind. And they're like, why the fuck would you go back? Why the fuck would you fly over one? These are all honest reactions for somebody. You know?
Why not?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It's just, the guy's just like, why not?
Hey, well, I got shit else to do. But yeah, so she was quickly becoming sick, horrified for all good reasons, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of, I guess, like flack thrown towards her that she was faking being sick. I want to throw out there that maybe before we brush her off as having some kind of case of, you know, I don't know, the UFO vapors, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's important to note that it's incredibly common for people to experience health side effects after a close encounter.
Yeah.
Like, that is not rare at all. And that those actual side effects are usually a major factor in what defines some of the most well-known cases as being legit. It's the health symptoms that people get afterwards that can't be explained or are super rare or this or that. This is very normal, right? It's what's honestly not normal is that only one of them was getting incredibly sick.
Not all of them. Yeah.
I digress. So with Nairi down for the count, but the objects still active and everyone else's excitement still high, Quentin managed to recruit a journalist named Dennis Grant, who was a longtime friend of Quentin's. And I'm assuming I haven't found an explanation for this, but like at the airport to say hi to Quentin, you know, just kind of like, how was your flight, bud? You know, like showing up at the airport. I have no idea why this guy was there.
Yeah, it's just like, who are these dudes in this small airport that's like not, doesn't seem like it's that big of an airport. So it's just like, he's just like, hi, just happened to be in the parking lot.
I was just coming to the machine to get a Coke and I saw you over there. How you doing, Quentin? You know, we need you.
Yeah.
Well,
get on board. Like, we're going.
Get on board. But yeah, so I'm not sure, but regardless, Dennis was immediately down to fill in for Nairi and handle recording the audio, kind of a key part of the whole reporting process, right? So with Dennis taking the baton, the team was able to get back up in the air, taking off for Christchurch towards Blenheim at 2:16 a.m. Now, to recap real quick, it's now been over an hour since they landed, right? And these objects are still being confirmed on radar, meaning we're now at the 2 hour mark of sustained confirmed presence of UFOs.
That's like the, that's, I mean, it's, they're like, okay, guys, come on. We see you're there. You can go, you know? Like that journalist is like, we saw it. We got it. You can just go. Stop standing by the door. Just leave, you know?
They just keep flying by, but they never say hi. Why don't they just come over and, you know, talk with us, get some tea or I don't know what Kiwis drink, but, you know, like something, you know?
Yeah.
Like, Kiwi juice, maybe. Yeah.
Yeah.
Where do you think all those like Craigslist missed abductions, like, you know, where do they meet?
This is where they meet.
Well, surprise, surprise. Everyone on board the second flight made visual contact with the objects again. And David, way more experienced this time filming in a cramped cockpit, was able to capture even more footage. This whole time, every radar sweeping the area of contact was picking them up, tracking their movements, and ultimately corroborating witness accounts that the lights were coming from solid material hovering in the sky. The second flight also allowed co-pilot Bob Gard to actually have time to, you know, process what he was seeing. First time, he's just kind of, what are you doing, Captain? Ah, you know, like...
Not be caught off guard, basically, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So he actually had time to, like, look at it as they were approaching him and be like, let's analyze this, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and so after analyzing it, he stated later that the large object looked like a, quote, squashed orange, while the other smaller lights were moving around it in ways that no aircraft he'd ever seen could operate. Quote, going up and down at an incredible rate. He's like, okay, now the, you know, adrenaline's worn off, I'm prepared for it, I know what we're getting into. I still don't know what the fuck that is. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
And so at 3:16 a.m., at John 3:16 a.m., an hour after takeoff. How did I miss that joke writing this? And so at John 3:16 a.m., an hour after takeoff, the crew landed safely in Blenheim. Once on the ground, Quentin, like, straight up just wasted no time with chatting with folks, processing anything. He grabbed all of the film and audio and immediately hopped on a flight, headed straight back to the home of Channel Zero's headquarters, right, in Melbourne, Australia. He was like, fuck this. I got evidence. I'm out.
Yeah, it's all good. See ya. He doesn't even thank anybody. He's like, just leaves.
Tommy Lee Jones and Will Smith are just approaching at the end of the tarmac. He's like, gotta go. And just like, run.
Gotta go, yeah.
No men in black for me, motherfucker. Whoop.
Beats him out of there.
Dipped out. Well, once back in the studio, he went to work immediately, looking over the footage, which he did admit at the time was, quote, extremely disappointing. But nevertheless, preparing and editing the story, which aired on Channel Zero on New Year's Day, 1979. Now, this, I really hope this goes to show everyone how fucking hard it is to film a UFO at night.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Now, Joey, it's not a UFO story unless there's blowback and broken hearts, right? Like, it's just true. Not complete. It's not a classic yeah. case. And I, right up the top, I'm saying this is one of the best.
Somebody's life has to get destroyed.
Multiple people, preferably.
Good.
Multiple Hopefully. People. Maybe Hopefully. Generations of people. Well, the Kaikoura Lights, as it became known eventually, is no exception to this golden standard, to this rule. Quinn's report went internationally viral immediately, like just boom. I mean, and how couldn't it? There's so much evidence. Everybody's willing to talk. Why the hell wouldn't it make international news? It was being covered at the top of news broadcasts across the world. We're talking like literally there's broadcasts from Africa, South America, Asia, Europe, all across mm-hmm. North America, right? Like if you're digging into this case and looking, you will find old reports from yeah. you know, basically around New Year's 1979 in a million different languages. Like at one point too, CBS, like here in the States, straight up offered to buy the footage from Quentin. Like point blank. They're like, we want this. We want yeah. everything that you got. He refused, thankfully. He was like, nope, it's totally mine. Right? So all of the witnesses involved were being flooded immediately with requests to give interviews. That's not surprising.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And in this case, especially the pilot and the co-pilot, Bill Startup and Bob Gard, as well as Quentin. Those were the three uh-huh. main folks that were being just blasted with like requests yeah. from all over the world, right? And each time they all refused, when they did give interviews, they all refused to label what they saw as being from Earth, while also not quite saying if it was aliens, but definitely sticking with speaking about what they saw that night. They didn't want to say what it was. They didn't want to say what it wasn't, but they did want to tell people who are like, well, what if it's this? And they're like, I know what the fuck that looks like. That ain't it.
Yeah. They're basically being politicians trying to sidestep the hard questions at a town hall debate.
Yeah. I mean, but it was the classic, I know what I saw. I know what it wasn't, but I ain't saying what it is.
Like, I know what I saw.
I know what I saw, but I won't tell you. No, but they yeah. just kept being honest to their observations. Their stories
That's good.
Never changed. And they're like, we're not going to say it's, you know, Quazga from Zeta Reticula that was coming down here to give us pancakes. We're not going to make other. We're just going to say this is exactly what happened. This is exactly what we saw.
Yeah.
And that we've never seen anything like it or anything that could come close, which like. Yeah. That's super respectable, in my opinion.
True.
Like, they yeah. held up under pressure, even though at this point, world scrutiny
yeah,
is
coming down
them.
On them hard. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Man, that's tough. That's tough if you're trying to, you know, a lot of times when people are talking about those things, they kind of get into being, you know, visited by extraterrestrials or whatever, you know, they kind of start going off into directions of like, well, the UFO or the extraterrestrial told me these things, you know, or I felt this from it. You know, instead of just being like, no, this is like the cold, hard facts of this. But it also does help that they were like journalists having this thing. So like understanding the idea that like we're getting scrutinized for this every little detail. So like our details have to all line up to what happened in the factual parts, because if that's the thing, then that's credible enough for people to believe us instead of, you know, us going out and be called crazy lunatics or, you know, which probably still happened.
Oh, yeah, of course. But like, it definitely does. Spoiler. Yeah. Good call on that. But here's the thing, though, too. This whole thing was being filmed.
Yeah.
They don't have to actually defend shit. They yeah. were like, check the tapes.
Mm-hmm.
This whole fucking thing, right? Yeah, yeah. These hour-long encounters. Boom. There you go. First flight, second flight. We got the whole damn thing.
Yeah.
They've got the tapes. They don't need to say shit. And like, you know, while other folks, they might have close encounters, they might have all these other experiences. In this, you know, specific situation, like, they didn't even have time to, again, you know, like, Quentin got off the plane, was like, I'm getting the fuck out of here. I know what I have is hot. I need to get the yeah. fuck back to safety. Basically,
yeah, yeah.
and get this out True. To the public as fast as possible. I mean, at that moment, you know, you might have laughed about UFOs. You might have, like, you know, been skeptical of it. Everybody still heard the theories that there's, like, you know, men in black and there's conspiracies uh-huh. and government cover-ups, especially by, like, the late 80s, early, or sorry, oh, late yeah. 70s, early 80s. Like, everybody knew about that. But then you just see some shit like this and you've got evidence in your hands.
Yeah.
You were going to be paranoid as fuck in that yep. moment. You're like, oh.
Yep.
shit. You know,
and especially, you know, especially when we're delving into the last like Australian case, remember
yeah.
about the you know, them kind of
the giant being, orb lights.
Yeah, the giant orb lights at the over. I can't remember the name of the.
It was Darwin. Yeah.
Darwin. Yeah. And it's just like how it was very tried to be hush hush and kept mm-hmm. under the rug because we don't hear about a lot of that stuff. So like this is like interesting because the guy's like, I know what I have. I got to go. So somebody's got to see this before I get killed or before this disappears. You know, something happens to this stuff.
And there's no convincing. There's no like, hey, I filmed this last night, Mr. Reporter. No, no, no. Mr. Reporter is the person who was there to film it that
night. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know? So he's like, oh, shit.
Yeah.
You know? And like, got the fuck out of there. They didn't have time to be like, wow, that was really crazy. No, 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 no.
He's not even talking to these people. He's like, let's go.
Yeah. Dips out, went back, got it done that evening, right? And he's like, I got, you know, at this point, 40, or probably what, like hour and a half of footage that he had to go through, right, in order to get that ready for the evening. But yeah, so they don't need to talk. They don't need any proof. They don't need people to believe them. They have the proof sitting there, right there with them.
Yeah.
And as long as they're not deviating away and letting those, like, leading questions, like, well, I know that you said it looked like a burning house, but, like, what did you really think it is? And as long as they didn't fall for that fucking trick that reporters do where the person then goes, well, you know, based on my spiritual beliefs, and then they're like, oh, they're a wingnut. They're a fucking wingnut. Ah, don't listen to them. Like,
traps them into that corner.
They always do that shit. They were just like, nope, saw what we saw. You know?
Well, yeah.
So like I said, this shit spread like wildflower. Like wildflowers.
Yeah, I mean, they do too.
Perennials.
Yeah, perennials. This shit spread like perennials.
But yeah, like I said, this shit spread like wildfire. It took off across the planet, literally, within like a day or so. Everybody's like, what the fuck? You had news stations wanting to buy it. You know, countries that didn't even have a translator hitting them up being like, we really want an interview. All this shit's going nuts. This led to the New Zealand's prime minister ordering that the Royal New Zealand Air Force not only keep an eye on the area, but place a reconnaissance jet on active patrol to monitor the region and have fighter jets at the ready to intercept any of these objects if they appear.
Damn. So they scramble some jets to make sure,
Dude, this is an official order, like got up on the news and was just like, look, y'all. We got this under control, but it was not like nothing happened. It was like, no, we're fucking ready. We're gonna
like
gun this shit down.
Yep. Which is stupid. I mean, you think about that though, but that's how all military thinks. It's like, oh, we just gotta shoot it down. It's in our airspace. Fuck that.
You don't have the proper paperwork, but if anything did kind of come of that, if anything happened, it hasn't been disclosed yet. There was a giant release, I'm going to say it was 2010, 2013, specifically from New Zealand. It was around the same time that the Australian, like, disclosure, like, papers, like, came out that we did on an earlier episode with objects that sound remarkably similar to these within, like, a 5 to 10 year gap, you know, hint, hint. But it was around that same time, you know, New Zealand also released a bunch of documents. There were some references to it. It didn't get, like, super into detail, actually. A lot of it, and I did include this in the show notes, a lot of it was, like, little kids, like, school children, writing the government and being like, would you tell me about the, like, Kaikoura lights? And them just being like, oh, well, actually, sweetie, it was a this and that and the other, and just dismissing a bunch of kids that were writing up. I know. So heartbreaking.
Poor kids, they just want to know.
Yeah. It's inspiring their imagination. You know, Black Cat Report is good for your young, impressionable children.
Yes. Now, we do not have explicit content of anything or any kind. So yeah, just give them unsupervised listening to this podcast. Yes.
Unsupervised.
And tell them
unfiltered.
To tell all their friends to follow us as well.
Yeah, we need a retirement plan. So please tell children, tell anybody's random child. Listen to
Yell
Black Cat Report.
Yell at them, actually.
Yell at them. Yeah. If we especially, we want to start sponsoring babysitters. So if we can get in with the babysitters, they can influence more. They're kind of, babysitters are like the original influencer for humans.
Yeah. This is like our 15-year plan, 10 to 15-year plan.
Yeah.
I would say. Yeah.
Well, naturally, in no time, universities, research organizations, government agencies, they all started to chime in with their two cents, cherry-picking parts of the testimonies, like literally cherry-picking parts of the testimonies, in an attempt to discredit the whole.
Of course.
Right?
Yeah.
Saying that it was Venus or Jupiter, or maybe their reflections, or how about headlights from cars and trains, maybe a Japanese squid fishing boat. Temperature inversions, an intricate nationwide multi-airport, multi-pilot hoax, and so on. Like, the hoax part of this was, like, honestly the weakest argument.
Yeah, it's just like, really? Like, dude. There's no... That's so stupid. Why would you... I don't get it. No. Dude. I mean, I get that they're trying... What they're trying to do, it's just like... Yeah, no.
Yeah, I just... Yeah, it's insane the lengths that everybody started, like, that they got to in terms of trying to be like, it's anything but what the pilots saw and have on film.
Yeah,
it is anything but that. And they're like, why? No, it wasn't this because of this. It wasn't this because of this. It wasn't this. They're like, nope. That's our official statement. And they're like, you're ignoring half of what we said. Yep.
Yeah.
That's our official statement.
You didn't even listen. Come on.
You didn't listen. How do I expect you to accurately report the facts if you didn't even listen to the first story? That's all I'm saying.
It's true.
But honestly, the only thing that I didn't see that people claimed that it was a weather balloon. That was like the one classic ingredient that was somehow missing from this story.
You know that somebody out there was just like doing a news report, like actually a news report. These idiots caught a weather balloon on their videotape, and it's like obviously weather balloons in the background of that person. Just floating by, and they're just like, see these back there? That's what they saw.
It's how, like, could they be so dumb as to see that?
How could they be so dumb?
And also hallucinated onto the camera that was recording.
Yeah, they must have burned it. They must have put it in the background themselves.
Yeah. Well, inevitably
CGI'd.
With CGI'd. Inevitably with so many experts attacking the witnesses from honestly so many random angles, because this all came in at once. You know, they're attacking their credibility. They're like, who is Quentin Fogarty? You know, like all the hit pieces are coming out.
Oh, God.
Everybody's getting torn apart. This shit all floods in at once. And with so many things coming at them, attacking from so many angles, and like none of them, which to credit, 100% credit to them, none of them were willing to budge on their story, right?
Yeah. Good.
Eventually, well, pretty quickly, the stress started to build and get to them, like hurting their lives, both personally and professionally, as well as mentally and emotionally.
Yeah.
Like, the shit fucking tore into them.
Yeah.
At one point, shit got so bad right after the release of that original air date on New Year's Eve, 1979. Yeah. It drove Quentin to experience a collapse caused by, quote, nervous exhaustion, which I'm pretty sure was like a 1970s Australian way of saying he had a nervous breakdown.
Yeah, pretty much. He got anxiety attacks and crazy and just went nuts.
People started saying that he was perpetrating a hoax. And like, it broke his heart. He was like, are you fucking kidding me? Like,
and
no,
the guy, guy literally like ran to get this printed, to get this like put into like, you know, a show just to do this, and took his hours and days, stayed up late just to get video of this, hired people probably maybe out of his own pocket to get this too, you know?
Yeah, dude, that has to fuck with you so bad, because like that's also not just like you know, he's a professional news reporter. It's not like he can, I don't know, he has this career where he's not in the public eye and where it's like, oh, his reputation got ruined. Maybe he has a chance, especially in the late 70s, you know, like to go to another town and make a name for himself.
Yeah.
And like, no. His face is 100% public. It's attached to this story. Nobody is going to not know who the fuck he is. And now people are trying to label him as a liar and a hoaxer and a fraud.
Yeah, he's going to have to career change. And like, how could you be after all that? How could you, people look at you and have an integrity after they like smear you so much of
Yeah.
Like, you know, you're honest too in that way. If, like, you're going into it in an honest way. And then this guy, like, he's like, look, this is what I saw. This is what it, the people are corroborating with me. Video cooperates
the
with
video.
Me. And, yeah.
Radar.
And it's like, radar cooperates with me. Like, stuff that's tangible. It's not just like I walked out onto my porch and got beamed up and went to another planet and came back, you know, and it's just you telling you know, that might happen to some people talking about it, but like this guy has physical evidence, video yep. evidence to show this, and he's still getting drugged through the mud because of it.
Yeah, no, I couldn't have said it better myself, but luckily for everyone involved, an optics physicist for the U.S. Naval Surface Weapons Center, who also fancied research into UFOs and would contribute his expertise to MUFON, saw the stories about the lights and decided to investigate.
Heck yeah.
That man was the legendary Bruce Maccabee. This dude, immediately on this case, like, he started seeing the bullshit come in from people saying it was Venus or it was Jupiter or it was a fishing boat or whatever the fuck. He was like, I'm literally a physicist in optics.
Yeah, yeah.
That's not true.
This guy, my favorite thing he actually said was, crying is not like, you know, crying is fine. It's just like showering for your eyes, you know?
Yeah. I always have a hard one picking between that as like my favorite quote of him and remember every time you cry, those tears used to be dinosaur pee. I'm always torn about which one to get tattooed.
Yeah.
I might get
your
both.
Eyes are just peeing, you know? Like that's another, yeah. Dude, mm-hmm. Dude's a genius. Quote machine.
So Maccabee, out fucking hesitation, he flew straight to New Zealand, right? Mm-hmm. And started interviewing everyone, and I mean like literally everyone involved, meticulously analyzed every frame of the footage.
That is a
That's
lot
a lot.
Of, damn.
And in the end, wholesale discredited each and every theory put forth by all the wannabe debunkers in less than 4 months.
Hell yeah.
This dude just came in and fucking whooped everyone's ass. All these official government organizations and research societies. He's
nice.
Like, nope, because of this. Nope, because of this. Nope, because of this. He went so far as to literally acquire, and I have translated, the logs of times and locations for squid fishing vessels from the Japanese government.
Hell yeah.
Dude, he went
there.
He's like, fuck you. Like,
he did the opposite of what people did to them. Of what
did.
People do to normal UFO. He was like, oh, nope, that happened. Nope, 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 nope. When everyone tries to dig into it and debunk these UFO cases, he did the other side of it and was like, nope, 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 nope. Told them, hell no, this is, it's real, you know?
Yeah, but, and like, props, dude. This dude came in like a UFO juggernaut and was just like, take care of this, and just fucking, I don't know why I'm giving him an accent, he's American, but he came in, whooped all their fucking asses, all the people talking shit, all the people trying to say this, and then he was like, nope, I'm a fucking expert in this now, I know, da 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 da, and fuck you.
Yep.
Fucking whooped their asses, and after all this digging and un-debunking, Maccabee presented his official report to the New Zealand Air Force. Like, he officially, it was presented to them, right?
Yeah.
And then proceeded to publish highlights from this massive nerd report, which I love. Proceeded to publish highlights of his findings in the MUFON Journal. And also actively debated skeptics in the peer-reviewed Applied Optics Journal, which I imagine has to be delivered in an unmarked envelope in order to, I don't know, protect subscribers from having to constantly knock the ladies off with a stick. Like,
oh, God, yeah. I mean, I will now be trying to subscribe to that, actually, just to see what is going on in that very, very, very interesting journal, honestly.
There is a funny breakdown that I came across in the research of, like, the actual debates and the process between, you know, what skeptic and debunker and Maccabee, as they just went back and forth and back and forth and back and forth and back and forth, sending letters in, like, high-level nerd research debates, and were just arguing for months and, like, into years in Applied Optics about the event.
They were slam-dunking on each other basically the whole time. And he'd just, you know, he'd just make a good joke and he'd be like, Kobe, and, you know, back,
your
fade
mom.
Away. Yeah. Did you even see the angle of the beam? I don't know why they're now British, but
the name is Applied. But yeah, so like, but the point is, like, this dude was a force of nature. Like, he came in, boom, like, started knocking all the shit out of the park while all these folks are there just getting the shit knocked out of them by debunkers and skeptics and, like, everybody that wants to hate on him. He came in, one-man show, boom, 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 presenting this to your government, presenting this internationally, presenting this in peer-reviewed scientific journals, right? I ain't just gonna leave tomorrow, baby. I'm going to stick around and keep arguing with these motherfuckers that started it for years because I saw what y'all did and that shit's legit. That's fucking awesome, dude.
Yeah, no, like, they needed that guy on
100%.
Their side to help because they were, if they're getting their lives wrecked, it's basically it's like your best friend that comes up behind you. You know, when somebody's trying to fight you at a club and your best friend is like this big guy walking up behind you, just like stands behind you and the guy's just like, I'm good. I'm good. He's like, damn right.
Yeah. Yep. Oh, 100%. And you're that person for me, Joey, next time we're in a bar. Well, as years went on, almost everyone eventually regretted ever coming forward. Naturally, right? Yep. Because even though you have these high-level nerd skeptic debates going on, a lot of times people just kind of go with the first thing that they hear and they might not pay any more attention to the case. Because, I mean, why are you listening to that shit? It already got proven wrong. Or it was proven a hoax. Yeah. They don't stay up with the updates of actually this Maccabee character came in and da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Right. They don't want to hear it. They've already dismissed it, right?
Yeah.
So not everybody's catching all these updates, which means day-to-day life. Like every time they go to a gas station, a convenience store, you know, wherever the fuck, like, they're getting shit talked. They're getting crapped on. People are making fun of them. But
you never find the rebuttal. You know, you rarely find the rebuttal or the retraction in the newspapers because of things. It's like that. And I mean, how many people realistically had a subscription to this Applied Science peer review? You know,
Applied
like
Optics.
Applied Optics peer review. Excuse me. I don't even remember the name. That's how how little people probably actually had a subscription to that.
I think at the time it was, I got the number, it was 3.
Oh, it was just those 3 people arguing too.
They started a journal just to argue.
Hey,
those administrative meetings were really awkward.
Things have been done for more petty reasons. So yes, that's probably true. And if you do have a subscription to this peer review, please email us at contact@blackcat.report. And also haters at blackcat.report.
What are they supposed to email us?
Just that you have it or that you are pissed off because we're making fun of it. So
teach us about Applied Optics. I'm going to like find those at like a Barnes & Noble or something and be like, damn, this is actually kind of sweet. Damn.
Yeah.
I didn't know that's how that worked. Like, I'm going to be like, all right, so this week's episode is sponsored by Applied Optics Journal. So as the years went on, almost everyone regretted ever coming forward and speaking up about what they saw that night. Like we were just saying,
for
sure, getting torn into. Well, Quentin even went so far, and this was not for publicity. He wrote a book in 1982 called "Let's Hope They're Friendly," which was actually something that we'll cover here in the recording when I play it, or like the video when I show it to you here, Joey. It was something that Nairi said when the object first approached and was like starting to fall behind them and shit. She said, let's hope they're friendly, right? Mm-hmm. Well, he wrote this in an attempt to clear up confusion about the night's events and to respond to harassment by skeptics. He was just kind of being like, look, I'm just going to get it out there because, like, people, you know, they come at you with, like, you told this person this, but then here you said that it was slightly purplish, not purplish slightly, you know, and just like shit.
Yeah.
Everybody's trying to dig in. And he's like, I'm just going to write the one definitive thing that I 100% say. If I fuck up saying anything, ignore that. This is my one truth about what I witnessed, you know?
Right.
He wrote a book just to basically tell people to shut the fuck up or refer to the book, right?
I mean, let's hope they're friendly could honestly just be talking about the reporters because, you know, like as I'm coming to this, he's like, let's just hope they're friendly and I don't get torn apart.
Yeah. That's a you're right. He probably, I mean, he was an experienced reporter. He probably knew
it was going to happen. That's why he wanted to do it right away. That's why he went with the facts. And he just kind of was like, well, wherever it goes from here, I can't control it anymore.
Truth. Mm-hmm. After that, the co-pilot, Bob Guard, straight up said that if this ever happened again, he wouldn't tell anybody.
Yeah.
He was just like, the exact quote was like, it's not worth the hassle.
Yeah.
Like, he was just like, nope. They all tried to be honest, and they sadly learned a terrible lesson. They were just like, fuck.
I honestly think that David Grush is probably feeling the same exact way right freaking now. As they felt. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And then to add more down the list of just like people that were like, fuck, Nyree Crockett, right?
Mm-hmm.
Never stepped into the spotlight and refused to talk about it until around 2018.
Well,
so let's see, 30, 40, 50 years later. Is that right? Mathing.
This 78, right? So
40 years. Yeah. So 40 years later. She didn't fucking speak about it. And part of it is because of what all goes down around this. Like, unlike her eventual ex-husband, David Crockett, the cameraman, who before that night was a staunch skeptic, but after became obsessed with UFOs and abandoned Nyree with their four kids as he traveled around to UFO conventions to talk about the experience until eventually settling into Hawaii and becoming a mango farmer. That's kind of how that goes. But he straight up abandoned her. She was having a terrible time. She was freaked out. And she was straight up left by everybody at the airport.
That sucks.
By her fucking husband.
Yeah. That's so terrible.
And she's just kind of like sitting there. She's like, bro.
Twiddling her thumbs. Like, I'm good. Like, this ain't going to ruin my life. I mean, she probably had some big foresight into this, to be fair. You know, like, thinking about it, like, okay, if I see this stuff, it's going to ruin my life. And yet, her life got ruined in, like, a secondary way, you know? Like, the person that was with her, their husband, was like, oh, no, fuck it, I'm going to ruin her life, too, by just going out and, you know, doing what I want to do now.
Yeah, it all just kind of, like, snowballed. But that's something that's super common in any of these, like, types of, I guess, like, paranormal situations or, like, sightings, whether it's, like, Bigfoot or ghosts or UFOs or whatever. The folks that are the hardest, like, the most staunch skeptics, when they fall, they flip to the opposite end. Like,
yeah,
they become
crazy.
Staunch, like, believers.
Yeah,
you know, like, it goes, woo, it flips to the other side, and that's what this dude, and I'm not going to say there probably weren't, you know, red flags or yellow flags before that, but he just straight up, like, left to go speak in Europe and the United States from New Zealand and never came back to New Zealand.
Wow.
He fucking abandoned them.
Yeah, literally.
Not just at the airport, but then their entire life and their kids.
It was a microcosm that... flight, he abandoning her there and probably just was like, I'm gone forever. He got famous. So
unidentified fatherly object. Now Ian Ufendahl, the officer who first saw the lights at the base at the beginning of this episode, he went on to keep writing letters to the Air Force during all these investigations and shit. And his whole point was like, hey, you know, the literal prime minister just said you guys are supposed to be looking into this. I was the person that started this whole snowball going downhill. Here's what I saw that night. Would you like more information? And the, you know, Royal New Zealand Air Force, they were just like, oh, well, we'll reach out to you if we need anything. And he's like, but I was the one that started. Like, I saw it. I have all the times. I documented it. I made the phone calls. I can confirm that, like, I know how investigations work. You should probably be asking me information. They're like, huh? No. We'll let you know when we're ready. And they just kept pushing him off until eventually he'd later come on to say that, like, it was a farce. It was complete bullshit. Their investigation was trash. Don't reference their investigation. They didn't interview anybody that was there that night. They didn't talk to anybody, but still they managed to try to come up with an argument about what took place that obviously was like, oh, it was just this or it was just that, which, you know, Maccabee comes in and knocks down those cases and stuff because they weren't based in fact. But yep. This does give an idea about like what happened behind the scenes. Now, with all that said, that didn't necessarily like push Ian away from the story. I mean, how the fuck couldn't it? You know, you see the sighting, it's this, you make this phone call, and then all this shit starts to play out. He was kind of far enough away from the spotlight that he could kind of, you know, witness and almost maybe enjoy this process of like validation that's happening. He kept digging while he was in the Air Force, and he kept digging years after getting out of the Air Force until eventually he started finding other government reports of sightings in the Kirikou Mountains, as well as responses that were happening from bases of flights of fighter jets to unknown bogeys in the region. All of this would eventually add up to him telling everyone in a documentary, which I'll have the link to in the show notes, that his conclusion was that there was an active UFO crash retrieval taking place in that mountain range, but not by a shady government agency, but by the UFOs who were searching the area in an attempt to rescue one of their own.
Aww.
That's it. Link to watch some of the super grainy videos will be in the show notes. I highly encourage you guys to go like check them out. There's so much more to this that like you can get into. There's a lot. There's a lot into it, and there's movements that the lights make, and they're not impressive. It looks like a light in the sky at night. You go take your camera outside and point it up at the stars and try to get a good video, and that's about what you're going to see with this, with the exception of just a couple little frames and a little bit of the dialogue which is happening in the background from Quentin when he's explaining, you know, things like, you know, it's large, it's a bright object, it has almost an iridescent a dome on top of it, and I guess it's kind of a classic saucer shape, and it's and like they're explaining UFOs. they're looking literally at a fucking UFO. And there's a very famous figure eight, which I'll probably make the cover of this episode. It's imagine the lazy eight or the infinity symbol, but just cut that in half right at the middle point, right? Or an hourglass shape, cut it at the part where the sand goes through. It's kind of a flight pattern in that direction. It's one frame of the footage, and it shows how unbelievably fast, when they're talking about all those geometric patterns and shit that were happening, how fast that shit was moving. It was like one frame, and it was just checking the tracers of how fast this shit was moving. It's fucking nuts. It's fucking nuts. But this is something to this day gets brought up in ufology. I know Ross Coulthard has straight up said, very famous UFO reporter. I mean, he's a famous reporter, award-winning reporter for a lot of other types of news. But lately, past few years, he's gone deep into UFOs, and he's really been pushing the subject. He was the one who first interviewed David Grush, for instance. Mm-hmm. That was Ross Coulthard.
That's the guy.
Yeah. So he straight up said in a fairly recent episode of his podcast, Need to Know, he's convinced of a massive, massive cover-up taking place specifically because of the Kaikoura lights. Because this became such massive news and then was shut the fuck up.
Yeah.
Which is why people today are like, the what? All right, folks in New Zealand know exactly what this is. Folks outside of New Zealand barely heard about it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, I've never heard about it, but now I have, you know. Thank you for doing all this digging research into it, Gil. It's crazy. I mean, to be fair, probably the UFOs were just, the aliens were just going around trying to find their buddy. They left a disco squid earlier.
Nice. God damn it, we left him in Tokyo and he ended up on a squid boat.
Yeah. Man, this is an interesting time. What are you guys doing here?
Hey.
We fish for squid.
We work here.
We work here. What are you doing here? I woke up here. You're not my friends. Just jumps off the boat.
You're not my squid mommy.
Nice.
Should I continue on, Joey, and tell you about what I learned about temperature inversions?
No. I think we just save that until...
Please?
No.
No?
Okay, that's fine. Yeah, go ahead and tell me about your temperature inversions.
Can I tell you? I did a bunch of research on temperature inversions, and here's the thing. The timing of when temperature inversions would have happened in New Zealand matched up perfectly with the dates of the first sighting and partially with the dates of the second sighting, right? But, and here's the thing, the conditions were exactly the opposite of what needs to happen in order to create or sustain temperature inversions. Also, the whole, like, bright as a nuclear blast and flying over it and it following them thing. But that's not the point. Joey? Joey?
Yeah, just inversions. Yep.
I was about to tell you. So, like, they can last for several hours to days. They usually start around dusk, around 3 to 5 hours before sunset. They can sometimes, and they can last through the evening until sunrise, which would have matched up perfectly and could have arguably been used to explain why it was showing up on radar. But here's the thing. The weather patterns, the topography, wind speed, rain, all these things help to remove... Joey?
Remove what? What?
Sorry, I know I'm blowing your mind here. They stand to get rid of temperature inversions. Now, here's the real question. How do you break a temperature inversion? Okay, because that is going to decide on whether or not it was involved that night. Well, a temperature inversion, actually, so it frequently develops during the evenings and at nights and can occur at the surface or aloft in the atmosphere during the daylight hours. Like, yeah, it's... I'll make an episode.
You lost me.
Y'all are the best. We hope you have a fantastic week and year.
I hope your holidays are great and your new year makes a new you.
Mm-hmm. Volume 2.
Hint.
Bye.
Later.